Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, everyone. Welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey and Chad here, your host for this weekend's edition. Also, your host throughout the week on our website, kereport.com, and podcast, The KE Report. As always, we had a busy week talking to analysts, newsletter writers, and a lot of management teams from companies that we follow, just trying to get a handle on these markets. And we did get kind of a nice run this week in markets, even in metals. The dollar kind of slowed down its upward momentum. A lot for us to talk about. So in these first two segments, we're going to focus more on market moves and different sectors. Last two segments, we're going to focus a bit more on the resource sector. So to kick off the show, we are chatting with Rick Bensignor, president of Bensignor Investment Strategies, writes the institutional newsletter, Supposedly Irrelevant Factors, that is read by some of the most successful hedge funds in the world. And on the retail or individual side, Rick writes in the No Trader, as well as a piece called 7-Eleven, where he picks no more than 7 of the 11 spider ETFs with the goal to beat the S&P. And as we've heard from Rick when we talk to him every month, he has continued to beat the S&P. So Rick, before we get into market commentary, I want to talk about this ongoing AI boom. It's taken market participants by storm. It's moved NVIDIA. That stock has just exploded higher. There's clearly a lot of money still looking for these newer speculative areas, plus the comments that this AI boom could be the next step for society, almost like the internet moved people forward into a different world. Maybe AI will do the same. Rick, what's your thought on this whole AI boom right now?
Well, clearly investors are looking for exposure in the area. It's the latest hot thing that, let's say, replaced crypto from a few years ago. No doubt that there's a pile of cash that continuously moves into this. And, you know, we've seen what happened to some of these names recently, and NVIDIA going, you know, last week's low in NVIDIA was 298. Last week's high was, or even maybe it was even this week, I can't remember, 420. I think it was earlier this week. I mean, that's incredible. And, you know, the stock's still hanging out near 400. Now, I put out a flash note to institutional clients this week of why I'm not buying NVIDIA up near the highs of the week. And it's a target that's been in place since the low of the fourth quarter 2018. So when NVIDIA got down to whatever that low was then, I can't remember, it projected a price of as high as $417 and change. And, you know, we hit that this week. And so to me, I'm telling people not to be buying it up north of 400. And certainly we actually got a 10% pullback in a matter of 48 hours, but we're back to near 400. And I don't think that this is the time or place to be putting exposure on there. And you look at across the names that have jumped up recently, there's clearly this whole push into this space. And is it too early, too much, too soon? Maybe, you know, it's a little overdone near term, but you know, how much do you think NVIDIA is going to pull back? And, you know, are you going to even get a chance to buy it at 300 in the next 6 months? I don't know. I can tell you from a psychology point of view, there's a rush into this as if it's the next hot thing, and people on TV are talking about it as, you know, Internet 2.0 or whichever way you want to think about just how much the Internet changed society that AI will. I'm not a huge fan of AI. The early stuff, you know, going into ChatGPT and asking it to do stuff, that's fine. But I think that it's going to get to a point where it becomes awfully dangerous. And we're already seeing examples. in places where this can replicate people's voices. It can make it look like you're watching a live video of somebody talking, and it's all done through technology. They'll, before you know it, they'll start bringing historical figures from the past back being alive just from photographs of them and being able to then translate those photographs into modern day. And I think it reaches the point where technology has, or can, it's not quite there yet, but can really invade the safety of being a human being who expects certain society to be certain ways, and just personal safety, and having machines that can replicate, Corey, your voice and make you say things that you never said, and having that then go out, let's say, on social media, as if it literally represented you, I think there's a danger. And I don't know how society stops it from happening, because technology just always moves forward. And go back 20, 30, 40 years, and there were movies that anticipated that this was coming down the road. But I do think there's a certain element of danger to it. And I don't know how you get in the way of it crossing over the moral and ethical lines of what technology can do. But for right now, it certainly feels like, looks like, smells like it's the next great thing. And people are jumping on board to get ahead of it. Now, is NVIDIA truly worth $400 a share? I'm not a fundamental analyst who can dig deep into their balance statements and income statements to tell you if that's really where this should be worth. But it's probably fair to say that even if you paid $400 a share, and I'm not recommending you do, you probably over time will still make money with that. But from a risk, I had two conversations about this in the last 24 hours. If you paid $400 a share, let's say you got in now, how do you manage the risk on that trade? Where do you stop yourself out? Where is the level at which, if NVIDIA sold off to, that you are safely, with the proper assumption that if it breaks under a particular level, it implies that it's going well lower. And right now, I'd say that there is no level that's reasonably close, even the $298 level from a week ago. I mean, if it pulled back to that level, if you paid $400, you'd be stopping yourself out, just as a ton of other people would be interested in being a buyer. So you can buy any one of these names up as much as they are. And this, you know, this was a $100 stock last fall. That's now $400. But forget about managing risk on it. You are basically saying, I'm going to hold this for 5 or 10 years or more, and it will be worth more over time. And you cannot think of it in terms of, I don't think you can think of it in terms of a trade. Now, it doesn't mean you can't make money paying $400, but you simply can't manage risk. And when you can't manage risk on something, it's not something I will get my clients into.
Well, Rick, another question that comes to mind, and some people are saying, yes, it's the Internet 2.0. But when you think about how the Internet really rolled out, it took decades, but really in the late 90s is when it started building steam. And by the end of the 90s, we all know what happened. It was a dot-com bubble, where everybody and their grandmother wanted to attach themselves to the internet, even if they didn't know what they were doing, even if they didn't have a valid business online, they wanted to have a .com, and that created the .com bubble. And we had things like pets.com. We had a lot of companies that went the way of the dodo bird, and only a few survived. Now, the ones that survived were great long-term investments, and they became household names. They became the Microsofts and the Apples that we know today. But most of the companies and the Amazons, but most of the companies did not. And in this rush to have everybody pile back into a new thing, investors are always looking for the latest trend. But when you look at NVIDIA, since we've been talking about it, it's got a PE ratio of 206. Is that even in the ballpark of sanity, or has that just gotten way ahead of itself? So from a short to near-term perspective, maybe 6 months to 2 years out, are people getting into these stocks that may have that same kind of dot-com effect where a lot of the air comes out of the balloon after this rush is over?
I agree with that. It's already priced somewhat crazy. It's trading, I don't know, something like 60 to 80 times forward earnings. It's already a, I'll use my grandmother's word, Meshuggah price, that's kind of the word crazy in Yiddish, it's already valued at a ridiculous level. So also paying $400 a share means that you're just fine on paying a ridiculous valuation on the company. But part of investing is also getting ahead of other people's absurd decisions to take advantage of that. And if you're good enough to be able to get in and then, most importantly, get out before the whole thing falls apart, then you make money and you walk away a successful, you know, trader on that particular name. Yeah, the valuation is already nuts, and it doesn't mean it can't get more nuts, you know, higher level of nutsiness. I'm trying to remember the phrase I used to say, stupid knows no boundaries. So if somebody wants to pay this valuation, that's fine. And you might be able to get away with doing it, because all you need are more fools, people more foolish than you to do it. We look back in history in the markets, and plenty of times you can find those type situations that you can get away with it as long as you also have your exit in time. Because if you don't, then it all falls in an instant. There are just simply no buyers left to deal with the rash of sellers that come in. And that's when things collapse.
Yeah. Well, this is the one constant of markets, isn't it? Sectors get overheated, money rushes in, money chases other money, and, well, sometimes it turns around very, very quickly. This kind of ties into the broad averages right now. As much as we're seeing U.S. markets move to highs for this year and continue to move higher, the one biggest argument is there's no breadth. This is being led by, let's say, five-ish stocks carrying these indexes higher. But it still means money is flowing into stocks and broadly into the indexes. How do you view a market like this, Rick, where there is some upward momentum, but it is just so concentrated in a few stocks?
So part of this I addressed yesterday in a piece I wrote to my In the No Trader clients. And what I suggested is that typically when I refer to the market, I'm talking about the S&P 500. But this year, you cannot talk about the marketplace as if there is the market, because the S&P 500 right now, the top 10 names, I'm trying to remember the numbers I looked at yesterday. I think the top 10 names were 30% of the S&P, and the top 36 names in the S&P represent 50% of the index. That's unheard of. So when you talk about, you know, bullish the market and you look at the S&P, here's what I'll say to you. And this is probably true for all the bulls out there who have a platform to express their opinions in some type of public way in media. I don't mean like just an individual saying something on social media, but anybody who's covered in the press and the bulls. My guess is, even if the S&P up, what's it now, probably about 11% or so, 12% on the year, my guess is their account isn't up anything close to that. Because unless you have those names concentrated in your account, the average stock is only up a small amount this year. The Russell 2000 is nowhere. So you have an NDX, or let's say through the ETF market, the QQQ, what we call on the street the Qs, right? The Qs that are flying. But if you're in IWM, Russell 2000, you're up nothing. This is truly the haves and the have-nots. So the average stock is nowhere this year, and certainly nowhere close to what the S&P or the QQQ indicates, because they're so top-heavy and cap-weighted. So when we talk about the market making new highs now, and the S&P crossing over 4,200 and already pushing towards 4,300 today with another 50-point up move we've got today on Friday, the market looks great, except it's really a couple dozen stocks. The average stock has not performed. It's not close to anything that these are. So even though the nomenclature is talking about the market, let's all remember that we're really talking about a dozen names or so that are really representing the bulk of what you're seeing when you turn on your TV or open a Wall Street Journal and see what the market's done. The market is really a few names. So I'll venture a guess that most people's accounts aren't up anything close to what the S&P is up this year, and certainly not what the NASDAQ's up.
Rick, I think that's such a cogent point, because people say the market as if it's all stocks. But to your point, the market breadth, it's not that some stocks haven't participated as well. There's a lot of sectors and stocks that are down substantially closer to their 52-week lows. You mentioned the Russell 2000, but obviously the financial sector hasn't been winning any awards this year. And there's a lot of other stocks. So if you're a stock picker, you may not have results anywhere close to your point where the indexes are. But in your experience, after having tracked these markets for decades, when you see bad market breadth almost across the board, and then only a very sliver of narrow leadership carrying the torch, is it a situation where eventually that money disperses out and you see other sectors rotate higher and maybe some of those mega cap stocks lose a little steam for a wider market breadth? Or in the past, when you think of like the Nifty 50, when people piled into that in times of concern, or even in the dot-com bubble when people piled into the tech stocks, sometimes it's a harbinger that there's another leg down in a larger bear market. How are you reading the breadth in relation to how things may translate moving forward?
Well, take a look at this. The S&P equal weighted index, and there's an ETF that actually you can trade, just like SPY is for the S&P 500. The ticker RSP, Rick, Sam, Peter, is the S&P equal weight, the S&P 500 equal weight. Last Friday's close was the third lowest Friday close of the year. At the same time, the S&P made its best close of the year. That's how much difference, even within the top 500 names, there is a bifurcated market between the haves and the have not. And that's, now you're talking about the top 500 companies in America. Get down to the Russell 1000 and Russell 2000. Of course, the Russell 2000 is beyond the Russell 1000, so it's actually stock 1001 through stock 3000. You're talking about lots of names that have losses this year and continually become, and this is the next thing I want to talk about, a source of funds for these high, for these mega cap names that are ripping to the upside in the tech space. Healthcare has gotten decimated this year. Staples completely fell apart in the month of May. Financials obviously have been in trouble and continue to be in trouble. Is healthcare in trouble as a sector? Is there something that's dramatically changed across the healthcare space? Absolutely not. It's still where we're going to get innovation. It's still the source of, you know, how is it now that a baby born in the United States in right now is estimated to have a lifespan of 103 years. It's because of the technology and what's going on in healthcare research that's allowing people to live longer and healthier lives over time. But yet these stocks are getting killed. Why? Because it's part of the game of trading. If you're going to buy mega cap tech names and all of a sudden have to pay $400 a share for NVIDIA that you only had to spend $100 a share for back 9 months ago, then you've got to be able to come up with that extra $300 per share from somewhere. And what happens is you're seeing some of the defensive sectors getting decimated in order to fund the continued purchases in these mega cap tech names. So there's a point to where you just stretch that rubber band too much, because you've put so much, you've so devalued, let's just use healthcare as a space, you've so devalued the healthcare space in order to just simply be a source of funds that longer term value managers start buying into the weakness. And at some point that will balance out and you will see a bid come back into healthcare. And then there might be some headlines that are positive for the space or something, and headlines at the same time that tech has gotten crazy, da 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 da. And then you start seeing some of the unwind where money will come out of tech and start going back into some of the beaten down sectors. That's the sector rotation game. And that's essentially, you know, at the beginning of our time together today, Corey, you were talking about that I have something called the 7-Eleven report. The 7-Eleven report is designed to outperform the S&P by being in no more than 7 of the 11 macroeconomic sectors at the start of each month. So if there are 11 sectors in the market in their proper weighting, whether it's, you know, technology, staples, consumer discretionary, real estate, healthcare, et cetera, there are 11 macro sectors to the market. In their proper proportions, if you invested in all of the 11 sectors, you'd get the same thing as the return of the S&P, which is collectively those 11 sectors put together as an index. Since August of 2020, by being able to anticipate what sectors were going to be hot and which ones were going to fall out of favor, in 34 months, yep, 34 months, because at the end of July, we'll have a three-year track record on this. I have outperformed the S&P by now 13.58%. So roughly 13.5%. If you had $100,000 invested in the S&P, you'd have an extra $13,580 by having listened to how to properly allocate the sectors as compared to simply being the market. With a once a month, 15-minute change that you need to work on to just, you know, reallocate per our instructions. That is huge. And this game of sector rotation, exactly of what your question to me was, of being able to determine when sectors were going to be in favor and when they're going to not be in favor, is really what the whole game of active money management is about. Last December 1st, I took out financials from our portfolio because relative to the S&P, they were already looked tired to me. And that's before any of the Silicon Valley Bank stuff showed up in March and April. It just, we were able to see from a variety of ways we measure markets what was likely happening there without knowing that there was going to be such a big story that totally changed the game. You know, we went into healthcare and December of 21, just before healthcare took off versus the S&P. So the whole game, really, when you hire a when you invest in a let's say a mutual fund, you're really investing in the portfolio manager's ability to outperform a benchmark. And we know historically, the number has always been that kind of 6 out of 7 can't do it. And the thing is, the more realistic number is that 96% of portfolio managers fail to beat their benchmarks over time. So it's a matter of understanding the game in a way that we do. And of course, you know, I've told you before, my background in behavioral finance, and you know, I brought the entire certificate program to NYU. They came to me to build it, to teach it. Understanding markets beyond what you simply see or hear on TV and what you simply can determine by digging into the fundamentals, there's a whole separate side, which is understanding the psychology of decision-making and when, how, and why portfolio managers make the moves they do. That if you understand that and have the proper tools to use along with it, you can actually do better than the markets over time. And that's, you know, that's what my goal was when I started the 7-Eleven report. And it's why I have so many subscribers to it, because it just continuously chips away at the S&P performance such that now 34 months into it, I think we're outperforming by about 30 bips a month. It's I'm very proud of the results. And it's something that I think your listeners should consider looking into, simply because most people have exposure to the market through passive ETFs, and certainly college endowments do, and pension funds do, and insurance companies do. And what I'm proving here is that all the stuff about random walk theory and you can't beat the market is not true. Most people can't, but at least over the last 34 months since I actually tried to do this in an organized way and in a public way so that everything is published and fact-checked, outperforming by almost 13.6% in a couple of years total is a massive home run.
Yeah, well done, Rick. It's not easy beating these markets. Actually, the markets beat a lot of people, as you said, but hey, you've done well with that 7-Eleven report. I'm very impressed.
This has been a tough year. I mean, you talk to portfolio managers. This is one of the toughest years we've had, certainly in the last several years. You know, 2021 was straight up, not even 5% pullback. 2022 was pretty much straight down with a couple of hiccups along the way, but the hiccups we were actually, you know, got bearish at the right times. 2023 is a total mishmash of a year, and the moves in the sectors are incredible. I mean, look at energy. Energy was best sector last year, worst sector this year, worst sector in 2021. It's all over the place.
Yeah, boy, oh boy, these markets have been dynamic. Let's move our focus a little bit to some other sectors. I want to start off in currencies with the U.S. dollar, because the U.S. dollar, having a great month of May, for most of May, it went pretty much straight up, started to turn around at the tail end of May, and people are wondering, did it just top here? Did it just make kind of a lower high just below that 105 level? And more importantly, is the dollar more in a downtrend? Is it going to level out? What's your outlook for the dollar?
So I turned bullish the dollar a month ago. Corey, you get my weekly report. We actually went long the inverse bearish dollar. It was a way of getting long the dollar in what actually ended up being a more sensible way than just buying the UUP, which is the ETF that is a bullish dollar play. Nonetheless, I put out using the dollar index as the benchmark for this, a 104.70 target. And to the tick, this week's high is 104.70. And now we've pulled back some. So we've taken half off and we've moved up our sell stop. So it stopped exactly where I expected it would get to a month ago. But I'm willing to still keep half on should we be able in the next few weeks to push above this week's high and then hold that 104.70 in the dollar as a potential support level. Right now, it's absolutely resistance, and that's why we took half off. The dollar stopped going down where we expected it to. We put out early this year, it was late last year when it was trading up at 113 or something like that. We put out a 100.5 to 101 downside target. And that's, I mean, if I can pull up a chart, this year's low is 100.79. So literally right into, again, where we expected. So then it got tested. We got down there in January. It got down there again in the beginning of April. And then we bought it at the beginning of May, just right near the bottom, and just took out a few hundred points in the dollar. So I'm willing to play it. Obviously, the strength in the dollar the past month has taken its toll on gold, and we can talk about that in a second. But anyone playing the markets does generally need to get a sense of what's going on in the other asset classes that affect the U.S. stock market. And typically, it's not tick for tick, so it's not 100% correlation at all. But generally, when the dollar rallies, stocks pull back. We're not seeing that right now, but if the dollar were to keep going up, that will become a drag on stocks.
Well, Rick, another asset class like the currencies that can affect the markets and can affect the commodities are interest rates and the bond market, one of the biggest markets on the planet. And when you look at what's happened in rates through the month of May, since we've talked last, you know, we came into the month of May with pretty low rates compared to where they had been the year before. And then over the course of the month, the 10-year and the 2-year shot up quite a bit. You know, when you look at the chart of the 2 year, it was down around 380, and then it got up just a week or two ago up to 460. It's pulled back a little bit since then, but overall we saw a big move higher in interest rates. So what do you make of the action in bonds and in interest rates?
So the general trend, there is a, since October when stocks bottomed, yields have generally pulled back. So they're actually trading in a downward sloping channel. But this part of the movement, the most recent touch to a channel line was the bottom channel. So in the first week in April, we bottomed this year at 3.25% in the U.S. 10-year. And of course, anybody who trades the U.S. 10-year knows how important 3.25 was, because that was the last high made before the dive to all-time lows a few years back. So it's an important inflection point. So we sell off to what used to be resistance, now support, and we've bounced. And we could still, I think that we're still not done moving higher. We're up about 50 bips or so in the last month. And maybe even 60. And my guess is we still move slightly higher here. It's got some type of resistance the last couple of weeks in and around, let's call it 3.75, 3.8%. But the downtrend line from October's high, which is the highest high of the whole cycle, comes in right around 3.9% or so now. So it wouldn't surprise me if we go and play with that over the near term, and then we'll see if it breaks out of the downtrend line and whether or not we start getting back towards 405, 415 or so, where we had the recent highs earlier this year. But it's generally directionless over the last several months with a slight negative bias to rates. But, you know, you even if you take a look at a 50-week moving average, most of the lows this year have come in and around that 50-week moving average, and we're above it now. So this could easily be what ends up being a flag pattern in what has been a bullish move in rates. And, you know, we've spent months now in this pattern since October. But if this breaks out to the upside and is able to hold, then it would suggest that rates still have well higher to go. And that's pretty much what the Fed has telegraphed to us for, you know, over 6 months already, higher for longer. And despite the fact that they may pause on Wednesday this week, don't confuse a pause with a pivot. There's nothing to indicate that they're done, but they may just pause right now. So, as is often the case, don't fight the Fed. Don't fight what they're telling you.
Yeah, well, we heard a lot from Fed heads this week, and even, I believe, at the end of last week, about how a pause probably is coming, but that does not mean they are done. Again, they will be data dependent. Let's talk about gold, because you brought up gold and how stronger dollar can hurt gold, also how higher interest rates can also hurt gold. But Rick, where do you see gold setting up here? Because you can make the argument that gold is setting up higher highs, higher lows, especially if this week was kind of a rebound turnaround week, but we are ending on the back foot for gold on this Friday as it is down as we are chatting. How are you viewing the gold trade right now?
So look, we have three tops or three highs in gold since 2020, north of 2000 an ounce. You had it in summer of 2020. You had it in early 2022. And then you got there again now. So you have potentially a triple top. At the same time, so you're in a, and you're in a big trading range from, let's call it, I don't know, 1650, 16 and a quarter or so on the downside, which has multiple lows, and now these three tops. So at the time, we had an upside target. I had published for clients for quite some time how important the $2,024 level was going to be in gold. And when I look at gold, I use gold futures as the proxy. And we did not close above, other than maybe $1 or something like that, we did not close above 2024 on any weekly basis. We got intra-week, we got as high as 2000, I think, was $85, $4 from the all-time high in front month futures. but we didn't make a new all-time high. And then when the dollar rallied, gold came off over the last several weeks, and it's fallen over $100 from what that high was. I had clients get out of, my recommendation was to get out of half. Our average exit was about 1995. And we actually, I recommended to them to buy gold tactically on Monday, or I guess Monday was the holiday, first day of the week this week, because we actually had sold down right to the uptrend line from last October's low. So we got a trading bounce from there, and it's, you know, we'll have to see, right? At this point, gold's down today, and it's probably going to stay that way. It's down $25 or so. So I don't expect any recovery today, but this is kind of what, you know, this week's lows are important levels to kind of look at, because either the uptrend line is going to hold, and if not, gold could pull back all the way to the middle of the range. And then you're talking about 1850 to 18 and a quarter as a downside target, which is pretty much where it bottomed in March this year. So the big picture in gold, I'd say long-term, the fundamentals remain positive. Shorter term, you're really into, you know, trading mode. And you've got some trap longs now who are long north of 2000, 2025. And until you really shake those people out, it may have a tough time progressing from here. You know, this is a long-term, multi-year sideways market. You have to look at kind of positioning and where people are stuck and how much, you know, there were headlines that gold made all-time highs, and it might have in the spot market, but front month futures did not. And even if it did, it was minimal. And this is often the case. The press jumps on and tells you, you know, new all-time highs, rah, rah, rah. And meanwhile, people who listen to that and think, oh, that means I should own gold, end up paying the high. So part of this is the game of trading and understanding how to trade and outsmart other people. And part of this is for the long-term investing point of view, which I think still presents the possibilities for gold. And it really depends upon, I'm less concerned about that the stock market moving higher means that gold has to go down. I'm going to pay more attention to credit default swaps and credit spreads in general between risk-free and, let's say, investment grade and risk-free versus high yield, to get a sense of the fixed income markets players, who are generally considered the smartest of all the different asset classes, what they are expecting for credit risk. And despite the fact that the S&P is moving higher, I think there's still some very significant risks out there in the marketplace that, you know, 15 stocks moving the S&P higher are not going to solve the problem of. So later this year, I think, you know, you could still easily see credit spreads widen out.
Well, Rick, one more sector that we should definitely touch on before we wrap up is the commodity sector. It's hard to cover it because there's so many different moving pieces in it. But in particular, I'd love to get your thoughts on oil. And then maybe Dr. Copper, just because copper is one of the indicators for the economic health of the economy. And with so many calls for a recession later in the second half of this year, or a contracting economy at least, and concerns about growth, not just nationally, but globally, what's your outlook for the commodity sector as we move into the second half of this year?
So I think, first off, as far as crude oil, I lean long without actually having a position on in the commodity itself. As long as $66 holds a barrel for WTI, which is a number that we went out with months ago as downside target, I think it was fourth quarter last year that we said oil, you know, the big test for oil is between $66 and $67. And that's where it's bottomed this year. Along with some downside exhaustion signals that are timing models that have nothing to do with just, you know, a support level I had seen. Oil's hanging in there. If oil gets multiple Friday closes under 66, I think it's suggesting a much higher odds scenario that a recession is actually going to take place. So I look at oil in the mid-60s as both where it's finding support now, and it's found it in the past, but also a sense of just like Dr. Copper gives you some sense of the economy, I think the demand for oil, which is a global product and needed everywhere there, you know, everywhere there is in the world, you are getting a sense of the demand for oil. And if it drops off beneath what's basically anything significant under 66, I think this gets to the mid-50s and opens the door. Therefore, even though it'll help the consumer because oil is cheaper, I think you have a much better chance of seeing real recession. That's number one. Copper has been sliding for some time now, but all still within kind of sideways action. I don't have a particular copper, you know, New York copper is trading at about $3.70, something in that area. There's overhead supply, anything north of, let's call it 410 or so, I think is overhead supply. And I don't think that it's going to have an easy time getting through that unless you get China back into the business of buying copper for expansion. I don't think it's in the cards in the near term. So I would say the highs we saw in January this year in copper are probably going to stay the highs for a while. And on the low end, let's see, last July, this thing broke under 3.25. I would say anywhere from 3 to 3.25 will be the lows going forward for the next 6 months. And then this is pure range trading, and that you cannot really decipher much from the copper market other than you're not getting any major rally at this point.
All right, Rick, thank you very much for really taking us around. Again, a wide range of markets, but really getting your thoughts on that AI sector. I find it so interesting, and some of these comments that are being made about it being the next generational step for everybody. If it truly is, then boy, oh boy, that's exciting. I look forward to these sort of advancements, progress in human nature. We'll see if it truly is, but wow, there's a lot of money flowing into it right now, and people are sure excited. Well, Rick, we're going to wrap it up here. As always, great chatting with you. I will post a link to the In the Know Trader website because that is all the retail and individual side of things. So, Rick, again, thank you very much for your time, and we'll chat again next month.
Great. Thanks, guys. Have a good one.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.